Now, from approximately coast to coast, Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding present the Bob and Ray Public Radio Program.
Thank you. And we want to just thank our sponsors who are, of course, with us again. Einbinder, the greatest name in fly paper. This year, more than ever before, make fly paper an important part of your life.
And Monongahela, the metal foundry that casts its ingots with the housewife in mind.
And incidentally, make a special note to listen on next week's show, because there's a special announcement from Monongahela. And we've had...
What's it about? I think it's the winner, isn't it?
I don't know.
It's the winner next week.
I don't want to give it away. But
well, let's see. We've come to the music time here so soon. We just get started. But it is music time at the old Bob and Ray Show. And so, for your afternoon listening pleasure, let's swing out now to the Polygon Ballroom in Larchmont for the haunting melodies of Herbie Waitkus and his orchestra.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, this is Buddy Blodgett speaking to you from the old Polygon Ballroom in Larchmont, where dozens of sailors on leave have gathered to dance with the local girls and listen to the music of Herbie Waitkus and his orchestra. Now I see Herbie is raising his baton again, so here's another foot-tapping tune played in the distinctive Herbie Waitkus style. Go, Herbie. Yes, sir. Herbie Waitkus and his fine orchestra with another of those short renditions that are so familiar in dime dance joints like the Polygon Ballroom. And now, as the boys in the band take a well-earned break, we're moving across the dance floor with our equipment to chat with the maestro. Greetings and welcome to our Bob and Ray microphone.
Who are you? What do you want?
Well, I'm Buddy Blodgett, and we're beaming the haunting melodies of your orchestra out across the air lanes to our Bob and Ray audience.
Well, I sure wasn't told about this. I'd suggest you pack up your junk and get out of here.
Well, I'm sorry, Herbie, but the pickup's been cleared with the management of the old Polygon Ballroom here in downtown Larchmont, and I'm not going to leave after we've paid to have our lines run in here, you know?
Well, then get over to the other side of the room someplace where you won't be under my feet, all right?
Well, I don't think we'll be in your way, and I'd just like to talk a little bit about your group's distinctive style before you play another song.
Well, look, pal, I got no time to talk to you about anything right now. The guys are getting back on the bandstand. The customers pay to get music, so buzz on. You understand what I mean?
Boy, your personality is a little different from the type we find among most popular band leaders, Bernie, but we can chat about that later.
Well, don't count on it. Now, just get out of the way and let us do what we're getting paid for. I don't want to have to get rough with you.
All right. Well, we're in agreement on that. I was just stepping aside so our audience can hear another haunting melody played in the distinctive Herbie Waitkus style. Yes, indeed. The melodic Holiday for Strings, as rendered by Herbie Waitkus and his band. Now, as we move back to the bandstand to resume our chat with the maestro, I have just one question that comes to mind.
Are you still here? Now, I thought I told you to stay clear over the other side of the room.
No, I just got one quick question came to mind. How is your group able to get that big band sound into a song like Holiday for Strings when all you have is a piano player, a drummer, and yourself on the oboe?
It's not an oboe, it's a bassoon. In addition to that, mind your own business.
Well, I didn't mean to pry. It just occurs to me you began this medley with a number featuring a lot of saxophones, then you had one that required a big brass section, and now you've done Holiday for Strings. But all you have up here is a pianist and a drummer and yourself on the oboe.
It's not an oboe, it's a bassoon.
Is that the only comment you have to make?
Well, What else do you want me to say?
Well, I thought you might explain how you're able to play three different styles of music when all you have in your group is a piano and a drum and that thing you're playing.
Well, I suppose you won't leave me alone until I give you an answer,
probably,
right?
Not, no.
Well, the truth is that there's a fourth member in my group, and he's the one who puts on old records. See, they go out over the PA system while the rest of us pretend we're playing. Now, I'm not proud of that fact. There's not much else we can do. A piano and a drum and a bassoon sound awful playing dance music.
Yeah, right. I can see how they would. Well, I tell you, dry your tears and don't feel ashamed. Anyone in your position might have been forced to do the same thing.
Well,
looking at that way.
You know, that's really nice of you. Now, as I raise my baton, here's a number dedicated just to you and your listeners.
Fine. Once again, here's Herbie Waitkus and his orchestra. Well, our time is about up, so amid the strains of another toe-tapping number played in the Herbie Waitkus style, this is Buddy Blodgett bidding you a bit of a fond farewell and returning you to our New York studios. Those remotes. Hey, we've had, I want to just mention the great response we've had to our new soap opera, Garish Summit.
If you like Garish Summit, you'll love The Secret Heart of Sable.
Well, that's right. This is, it's another story of today and days to come.
Well, it all began when Mildred Sanchez visited the office of attorney Marcel Menifee and was dismayed to find he would not defend her.
And when attorney Marcel Menifee suggested to Mildred Sanchez that she see Bernard Bennett, she flew into a rage and called Alma Everest, her best friend, and county recorder.
And together, they went to see Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp.
The meeting took place at Cliff House, the fashionable restaurant owned by Carl Ritter, Jesse Lee Poe, and Herbert Lindquist.
And it was at that time that Mildred Sanchez and her best friend, county recorder Alma Everest, explained the situation to the owners of Cliff House.
And Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp, who had already heard Mildred Sanchez's story, talked to Lou Kelso at another table.
And when George Adenauer, a waiter at Cliff House, overheard the conversation, he called Matt Dempsey, an underworld figure and part owner of Tom Roxy, the light heavyweight champ of Savo.
Meanwhile, Diane Ickes, who was raised with Mildred Sanchez, but was not on speaking terms with her because of a fight over Ralph Rouville, happened to be in popular Cliff House restaurant and overheard George Adenauer's call to Nat Dempsey. She waited till George Adenauer got out of the phone booth and then placed a mysterious call to Ned Gelding in Orchard Beach, Arizona.
And then Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp decided that the dark mystery of Cliff House might be solved by looking at the guest book
and bribing Rosetta Moore. For the privilege of glancing through the guest book was easy.
Well, the guest book of popular Cliff House contained the following names. Larry Hogle, the Dean Lynch, Arthur Stapleton, Clyde Decker, Lester Leonard, Patricia Cantwell, Lyman Lloyd, Mark Dodge, Gerald DeBono, Rosalie Curl, Ruth Helfand, and John Graffiti.
Somewhere in that list was the solution to the mystery of popular Cliff House and to Mildred Sanchez's troubles. And Irwin Kemp and Clifton Lindbergh knew it, so they decided to visit the guests who had signed the Cliff House guest book.
Nadine Lynch and Lester Leonard were the first ones that Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp visited.
And the difficulties they had were predictable because Nadine Lynch and Lester Leonard had moved, and the new tenants, Olga Blanchard and Otto Cannon, didn't know where they had moved to.
But the visit to Gerald DeBono paid off handsomely when Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp found a Cliff House menu in his room.
which seemed to tie him in with the owners of Cliff House, Carl Ritter, Jesse Lee Poe, and Herbert Lindquist.
And when Gerald DeBono lifted the phone and called his attorney, Marcel Menifee, who, of course, was the lawyer who had refused to defend Mildred Sanchez, Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp became suspicious.
And went back to Cliff House to tell Mildred Sanchez of their discovery. But when they got there, they found that Cliff House had been shuttered because of an obscure zoning law.
And as they prepared to leave the shuttered Cliff House, they were approached by a mysterious stranger who identified himself only as Mr. L.
And only after being severely coaxed by Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp did the mysterious stranger relent and give his real name, Lyman Lloyd.
And that's where we'll pick up our story. When we begin this fascinating new series.
Clifton Lindbergh and Irwin Kemp continue questioning Lyman Lloyd when you hear the first episode of The Secret Heart of Sayville.
Say, friends, here's a home decorating tip from our kind sponsor, the maker of Einbinder fly paper. Say, friends, are you ashamed of hanging fly paper in your home that clashes with the color scheme and with your other furnishings? Well, if so, you should switch today to Einbinder, because genuine Einbinder fly paper is offered only in a neutral tan shade that blends nicely with anything. So remember, gaudy striped or plaid fly paper may be all right for your downstairs rumpus room, but a conservative color is best for your living and dining areas. And the fly paper that's always in good taste is Einbinder, the brand you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations. Get some today. Now, another episode in the endless story of intrigue unfolding among the wealthy residents of Gary Summit. There in stately splendor, far removed from the squalid village below, they play out their petty games of money and power. Now, as our action begins, young Rodney Murchfield lies unconscious in the intensive care ward of the town's most fashionable hospital. An expensive doctor and nurse gaze down at his comatose form.
Well, it's just as I thought, Nurse Bogash. He's comatose.
Well, I can see that. He's out like a light, but is there any evidence of foul play?
It's too early to tell. He was found lying beside the gravel pit in his pajamas, but he may have just been out for a stroll when he suffered an attack of amnesia that caused him to collapse.
Well, I can't imagine why a man of his wealth and social position would be strolling near the gravel pit in his pajamas. What do his x-rays show?
Nothing unusual. That's why I've diagnosed his condition as amnesia. You may not know this, Nurse Bogash, but amnesia is one of the few conditions that doesn't show up on an x-ray.
You? Anybody home?
Back here, in the intensive care ward.
Doctor. You really shouldn't yell like that in the middle of the night. This room is full of sick people.
You're not qualified to diagnose their cases, Nurse Bogash. Only a licensed physician can do that.
Excuse me, I'm Caldwell Murchfield, Rodney's ne'er-do-well brother, who would inherit the whole family fortune if anything happened to him.
I hear the poor guy had an accident that may prove fatal.
All we know for sure is that he has amnesia. Just before he passed out, I tested his memory by asking him to name the state capitals. When I got to North Dakota, I found that he'd completely forgotten about Bismarck.
Gee, you'd think that getting hit on the head with a tire iron out near the gravel pit would do more to a guy than make him forget the capital of North Dakota.
How did you know he was found near the gravel pit?
I didn't. It was just a logical assumption. Gee, I sure hope the police don't start poking around here asking a lot of questions about this.
Faith and Bagara, is anybody home?
Well, we're all back here in the intensive care ward.
I think Nurse Bogash mentioned some reason for not wanting us to yell in here.
I certainly did. Just look at that monitor above the patient's bed. The needle's jumping all over the place.
Faith and Begar, which one of you would it be who's the presumed victim of foul play?
Well, it's the one who's lying down with his head all bandaged, officer.
Faith and Begar, that's young Rodney Murchfield, the sole heir to the fortune of old Agatha Murchfield.
You know, that's what I thought, too, when I first saw him, officer. But now I'm not so sure. From this side, he looks more like Willie Shoemaker. Or possibly even Tip O'Neill.
Faith and Begara.
Don't listen to him, officer. This loudmouth is Rodney Murchfield's ne'er-do-well brother. He stand to inherit the whole ball of wax if Rodney got finished off with the tire iron.
Faith and Begara clobbered with a tire iron, was he?
Well, that's only a rumor she heard someplace, officer. Personally, I think he just slipped and bumped his head a few times. So, why don't you go back to the station house and write it up that way? Here's $10,000 for your trouble.
Oh, no, no. You know, lad, you shouldn't be trying to bribe an officer of the law. It only arouses me suspicions. In fact, I'm placing you under arrest for the murder of Rodney Murchfield.
Well, I'm not sure you can go quite that far, officer. Rodney isn't dead, you know.
Faith and Begara, that's true enough. Well, I guess I'd best be getting back to me rounds then, but let me warn you, lad, don't try to leave town, or I'll tell your mother about all the peculiar things that have happened tonight.
Will Rodney regain consciousness to answer the embarrassing question of why he was at the gravel pit in his pajamas? Can Nurse Bogash avoid having her name dragged into the whole sordid mess? And what about Bismarck, North Dakota? Perhaps we'll learn more next week when we hear the doctor say,
I don't care what he wants, just keep feeding him green gelatin.
That's next week when we resume our story of wealth and intrigue on Gary Summit. Guest is Dr. Darrell Dexter. He's from Upper Montclair, New Jersey, and he is the world-renowned authority on the Komodo dragon.
Thank you.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Komodo dragon?
Yes, the Komodo dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's a ferocious carnivory found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago, and the nearby islands are Rinja, Padar, and Flores.
Where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, world's largest living lizard, is found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo and the Lesser Sunda chain, the islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. We have two in this country, at the National Zoo in Washington, and they are a gift of the former premier, Sukarno.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragons. Is that right?
Yes. The former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, gifted our country with two Komodo dragons some years back, and they reside in the National Zoo in Washington.
Well, now, if we wanted to take the children to see a Komodo dragon, where would we take the children to see a Komodo dragon?
If you were in the vicinity of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., you would take the kiddos to the National Zoo. And there you'd see two live Komodo dragons, the world's largest living lizards.
They're a member of the lizard family, aren't
they? Yes. They're the largest living lizard we have.
And they're carnivorous, I believe.
Carnivorous and ferocious.
Well, I think we're just about exhausted the subject. I want to thank you for coming by and telling us all about the Komodo dragon. It's been very interesting for me, and I know for all the listeners.
Hope so.
Do you have a ride home?
No, I don't.
Well, look, wait here, and after the program, maybe somebody will give you a lift, okay?
You're very kind of you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Dr. Dexter. Well, say, here's the timely reminder from your friends at the Monongahela Metal Foundry. There's no one time of the year when there's not a chance of friends or relatives dropping in at your home. Having unexpected guests see your dull steel ingots. A very embarrassing prospect for anyone.
But it is a fear you can banish forever once you've visited your Monongahela Foundry showroom and stocked up on those extra shiny steel ingots you'll be proud to display. Don't let unexpected company think you're a person with corroded ingots. See your local Monongahela sales agent today.
Well, you know, hearing all about the Komodo dragon and conjuring up thoughts of the Indonesian archipelago and points beyond kind of puts me in the mood for an interlude with a very old friend of ours. The Adventures of Charlie Chew, famed Oriental sleuth, as he and his number one son attempt to solve the case of a mysterious victim.
And so that's the thing that has my man stumped about the case, Chew. The murder victim was found right here in the middle of the room wearing an Army colonel's uniform, but there was no wallet or other identification on the body, so we don't know who he is.
May I ask, Inspector, one vital question?
Good gravy, Pop. We've just barely arrived at the scene of a killing that has the police department stumped, and already your keen mind has thought of a vital question to ask.
A number one son, like all-night gas station, never shut up.
Ah, gee, Pop, I wish you didn't always have to be such a wet blanket. You know, I get overly enthusiastic when I have a chance to help you work on a big murder case like this.
A number one son can best help illustrious father by holding breath until I beg you to stop. Which may be late next week.
Chew, what was the vital question you wanted to ask?
Wish to know whether other valuables also stolen from this room, or only wallet and identification of Colonel What's-His-Name?
Well, the people who live here aren't home, but from what we've observed, nothing else in the room has been touched. And that strikes me as strange, because there's a diamond necklace right there on the table. Why would any crook rather steal the laundry tags out of a murder victim's clothing than a $10,000 necklace?
Inspector Poe's very interesting question. Now, let us look at another question behind first question. Why would killer steal laundry tags unless he wished identity of victim to remain secret?
Gee whiz, Pop. You don't keep a secret by stealing somebody's laundry tags. You keep a secret by making the other person cross his heart and hope to die. Of course, come to think of it, this guy died. So it all fits together.
Number one son, like hermit, who stay in house at top of hill. Never run down.
Chew, I can understand how that boy of yours would turn any father into a basket case, but just then he almost made a valid point. Stealing laundry tags out of an Army officer's uniform wouldn't keep his identity secret. There would be too many records on a military man at the Pentagon, but we've already checked the victim's dental work, and the Army doesn't have a record of any colonel with two porcelain crowns on the upper left connected by bridge work.
Charlie Chew is most sad to discover how Inspector has failed to learn anything of killer's M.O. One who is clever enough to remove laundry tags from uniform will also exchange victim's dental work for that of someone else. Hence, any wise detective will first seek aid of Pentagon in finding out who Colonel lying at our feet could be.
Holy cow, Pop. I see what you're driving at. We don't just give the Army this guy's dental records and ask who he is. Instead, we find out which Army colonels are missing and then figure out which one this victim might be.
Charlie Chew is pleased to note that the blabbermouth son finally show intelligence inherited from father's side of family.
Well, I guess his comment might sound intelligent, except for one thing, Chew. The Pentagon says there are no Army colonels at all who are missing, so the victim isn't really an Army colonel, and that leaves us facing a blank wall.
A Fair Inspector thinks wall is blank only because he's unable to decipher handwriting upon it. Consider fact that victim is not truly a colonel, yet laundry tags have been removed from colonel's uniform worn by victim. Does this not then suggest that murderer himself was a colonel seeking to hide his own identity?
Yeah, it suggested that to me, but in addition to having no colonels missing, the Army doesn't even have one within 100 miles of here who's unaccounted for. So the victim and the killer have one thing in common. Neither one is an Army colonel listed by the Pentagon.
Oh, very interesting.
Hey, Pop, that's it. The inspector just said that the victim is not an Army colonel listed by the Pentagon, but since he's wearing a colonel's uniform, then use the process of elimination and you get the answer. He must be an Army colonel who's not listed by the Pentagon. And there's only one of those, Pop. This man is the unknown soldier.
Clever deduction by number one son proves wise saying of honorable ancestor. Everybody must be somebody sometime.
Gosh, Pop, if we had our honorable ancestors around now to give us their wise sayings, I'll bet we could make the police inspector look like an even bigger fool. All of which adds up to another Bob and Ray public radio program developed and produced for the Radio Foundation by Larry Josephson, who firmly believes that Pennsylvania Dutch funnel cakes are an invention of New York City street fairs.
Associate producer is Marjorie Van Haldren, who enjoys whistling the skater's waltz as much in summer as in winter.
Stan Free was at the organ, and our audio engineer was Joe Lopes.
Funding in part from the National Endowment for the Arts.
And the New York State Council on the Arts.
Now this is Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
And Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumbs.
Additional funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund.
For a free picture of Bob and Ray, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Bob and Ray Picture, Box 5000, GPO, New York 10116. That's Bob and Ray Picture, Box 5000, GPO, New York 10116. This program was independently produced by the Radio Foundation.
That's all.